Chapter 1. Where Darwin Meets Mendel. "Raise your hand if you're thinking of having a child more than 10 years from now," I asked the large audience of millennials gathered in the sleek Washington, D.C. conference hall. About half the audience raised a hand. I'd been waxing poetic for 45 minutes about how the coming genetic revolution will transform the way we make babies and ultimately the nature of the babies we make. I'd explained why I believe it is inevitable our species will adopt and embrace our genetically enhanced future, why this was both incredibly exciting and deeply unsettling, and what I thought we needed to do now to try to make sure we can optimize the benefits and minimize the harms of revolutionary genetic technologies. "If your hand is in the air and you are a woman, you should probably freeze your eggs. If your hand is up and you are a man, I encourage you to freeze your sperm as soon as possible." The audience eyed me suspiciously. "No matter how young and fertile you are," I continued, "there's a not insignificant chance you are going to conceive your children in a laboratory, so you may as well freeze your eggs and sperm now when you are at your biological peak." A wave of apprehension rolled across the faces of these high-flying young professionals. I could almost feel the conflict brewing. I had struggled for decades with the same question that seemed to be troubling them. How do we balance the magnificent wonder and brutal cruelty of our own biology? We are all born through a process that feels nothing short of miraculous, then immediately begin our never-ending and ultimately losing battle with time, disease, and the elements. We have a strong attraction to what we feel is natural, but our species is defined by our relentless efforts to tame nature. We want our children to be born naturally healthy, but there is practically no limit to how far parents will go in defying nature to save their children from disease. A young woman in a blue pantsuit raised her hand. "You've just explained where you think the genetic revolution is going and how we should prepare for it, but what about you? Would you genetically engineer your own kids?" Uncharacteristically, I froze. I'd been writing and lecturing about the future of human reproduction for many years, but somehow the question had never before been asked so directly. I didn't quite know the answer to the woman's question, and looked up for a moment to think. "The science of human genetics has advanced so rapidly that all of us are still racing to catch up. When James Watson, Francis Crick, Rosalind Franklin, and Maurice Wilkins identified the double helix structure of DNA in 1953, they showed how the manual of life is organized like a twisting ladder. Figuring out how to sequence genes just a quarter century later proved that the manual could be read and ever better understood. Developing tools for precisely editing the genome a few short decades later then allowed scientists to write and rewrite the code of life. Readable, writable, hackable, the scientific advances over the past half century have turned biology into another form of information technology, and humans from indecipherable beings into wetware carriers of our source code software. Understanding genetics as IT has led us to increasingly see the genetic variations and mutations causing terrible diseases and enhancing suffering both as the necessary cost of evolutionary diversity and like the annoying bugs interfering with any computer program. Continuing this metaphor, shouldn't we want whatever software updates that might be available to make sure our systems are running optimally? I felt my thoughts gelling. My eyes regained focus. "If it was safe and I knew I could prevent my child from significant suffering," I said, walking across the stage, "I would do it. If I truly believed I could help my child live a longer, healthier, happier life, I would do it. And if I needed to give my child special capabilities to succeed in a competitive world where most everyone else had advanced capabilities, I would at least think very seriously about it. How about you?" The woman swayed in her chair. "It's tough," she said. "I hear what you are saying, but something about all this just feels unnatural." "Let me push you on that," I responded. "What do you mean by natural?" Probably just things as they are, before they've been changed by humans. So is agriculture natural? I asked. We've only been doing it for about 12,000 years. It is and it isn't, she said cautiously, starting to recognize nature was a flimsy peg on which to hang an argument. Is organic corn natural? Go back 9,000 years, and it would be impossible to find anything resembling today's corn. You'd find a wild weed called teosinte, with a few sad kernels hanging from it. Add millennia of active human manipulations, and you get the beautiful yellow behemoth gracing our picnic tables today. So many of the other fruits and vegetables we eat, even the organic ones from Whole Foods, are in many ways our human creations coming from conscious and selective breeding over millennia. Are they natural? It's a gray area, she conceded, still holding to her original concept of nature. Would we be more natural if we lived in hunter-gatherer societies like our ancestors? Probably. I didn't want to keep pushing, but needed to make an essential point. Would you want to do that? An impish smile crossed her face. Is there room service? So, you are at the Four Seasons, and you get a terrible bacteriological infection, I continued. Would you want to be treated like our ancestors tens of thousands of years ago with incantations and berries, or would you want the antibiotics that could save your life? I'll go with the antibiotics, she said. Natural? I get your point. I looked around the room. We all have deep-seated ideas of what's natural, but much of it isn't that natural at all. It may be what's familiar to us from an earlier time, but we humans have been aggressively altering our world for millennia. And if we have been in the business of altering the biological and other systems around us for so long, must we think of the biology we have inherited from our parents as our destiny? Do we have the right, or even the obligation, to work out the bugs and software coding errors in the hardware of our and our children's bodies? The audience fidgeted. If your future child had a terrible disease that you knew would kill him or her, raise your hand if you'd be willing to subject your child to surgery to save his or her life, I pressed on. All the hands went up. If you could prevent your child from having the disease in the first place, would you do that? The hands stayed up. Keep your hand up if you'd do that by going through IVF and screening your embryos to make sure your future child wasn't at risk. The hands stayed up. How about by safely making one small change to the genes of your child when he or she is just a pre-implanted embryo? A few hands dropped. I turned to one of the young men whose hand has dropped, a preppy 20-something looking like he'd stepped out of the L.L. Bean catalog. Can you tell me why? Who are we to start engineering our kids? He said. It feels like a slippery slope. Once we start, where do we stop? We could end up with Frankensteins. It makes me nervous. That's a very valid point, I said. It should make you nervous. It should make all of us nervous. If you aren't feeling a mix of excitement and fear, you aren't really getting it. Genetic technologies will allow us to do wonderful things that will ease human suffering and unlock potentials we can hardly imagine. New versions of us, Homo sapiens 2.0 and beyond, will use these new capabilities to invent new technologies, explore new worlds, create phenomenal art, and experience an ever wider range of emotions. But if we don't get things right, the same technologies could divide societies, create oppressive hierarchies between enhanced and unenhanced people, undermine diversity, lead us to devalue and commodify human life, and even cause major national and international conflict. So who determines where this leads? Another woman asked. That will be the most important and consequential question we, individually and collectively, will ask over the coming many years, I said deliberately. How we answer it will determine who and what we are, where we live and can live, and what is possible for us as people and as a species. The audience sat up in their seats. I could feel anxiety levels rising in the room. We will have to be the ones who figure out where we go with all of this. That's why I'm here speaking with you. Our species as a whole will be making monumental decisions about our genetic future over the coming years. Some of these decisions, like passing laws, will happen on the societal level. But many significant choices will be made by individuals, like each of us figuring out how we want to make babies. Each individual and couple won't feel they are deciding the future of our species, but collectively we will be. That familiar mix of terror, wonder, and confusion I'd come to expect from all of my talks over the years spread across the room. Then, as always, the hands shot up. Like the seventh graders I'd spoken to in New Jersey, the high rollers and ideas festivals like Google Zeitgeist, Tech Open Air, and South by Southwest, the experts at Exponential Medicine and the New York Academy of Science, the Stanford and Harvard law students, and the scientists, scholars, and business leaders in conferences around the world, the audience started to understand and internalize the awesome responsibility this historical moment has thrust upon each of us. It is a responsibility that comes at an incredible inflection point in our history as a species, when our biology and technology are intersecting like never before and are upending some of our most sacred practices and traditions. Like the others, the Washington millennials were starting to grasp that the future of human genetic enhancement wasn't just about making a few changes to our and our children's genes, but about creating a new and very different future for our species. But to understand where we are going, we first need to take a step back to understand where we are coming from. For the first 2.5 billion years of life on Earth, our single-cell ancestors reproduced clonally. One bacterium, for example, would divide into two separate bacteria with the same genetics, and then the process would start over again. This was a great way to do things because you didn't need to waste any time and energy finding a mate. All you had to do was find food and divide, and your lineage could go on. The downside was that the clonal reproduction process created a lot of genetic consistency among the single-cell organisms in a given community, limiting the options available for natural selection compared to what would come later. This consistency, however, was not complete. Bacteria evolved a way to literally grab genes from other bacteria using microscopic harpoons we call pili. Still, while clonal reproduction helped bacteria pass on beneficial mutations, it also left some entire colonies at risk when dangers such as bacteria infecting viruses arose because the cloned bacteria possessed too many of the same inadequacies in their defense mechanisms. Sexual reproduction changed that in a big way. Exact copies in biology are rarely exactly perfect. Although it is impossible to pinpoint the exact time, the fossil record suggests that about 1.2 billion years ago, one of these simple organisms developed a strange mutation. Rather than just copy themselves or grab a few genes from other microorganisms, they somehow paired with other microbes to create offspring combining the DNA of both parents. Et voila, sex was born, dramatically expanding evolutionary possibilities. It took more energy to find a partner than it did to clone yourself. There were, by definition, no other potential suitors to contend with. Those on the lookout for optimal partners had to develop new, ever better capabilities to attract the best mates and fight off competitors. But once a mate was secured, they could more fully and more randomly mix their genetics when procreating, a huge advantage. Organisms that reproduced sexually had more genetic losers than their clonal forebears, but they also had a far greater possibility of evolving genetic winners. With so many different models of sexually reproducing organisms being constantly generated, sexually reproducing species were able to adapt more quickly to changing circumstances, do a better job of fighting off intruders and finding food, and speed up the process of evolutionary change. As one of them, our entire evolutionary history is made of these often random genetic mutations and variations, creating a multitude of new traits, the most useful of which spread across our species. Armed with these differences, our ancestors competed for advantage with each other and the environment around us in a process Darwin called natural selection. Over time, the process of sexual reproduction itself faced evolutionary pressures, to which different creatures responded in different ways. Some, like today's salmon, released as many eggs as possible into the world in the hope that some of the eggs will encounter sperm. Releasing thousands of eggs into the holes at the bottom of rivers increased the odds that at least some of them might be fertilized by male sperm, but this approach also eliminated the possibility of parenting. No matter what you may think about your parents, parenting itself confers huge evolutionary advantages. Rather than sending out huge numbers of eggs, other organisms, our more recent ancestors included, kept the eggs inside the females until fertilization, then gestated embryos inside their bodies. If sex were a game of roulette, creatures like salmon puts a chip on every number, but creatures like us placed our chips on a few single numbers. By producing fewer offspring than other mammals and keeping them closer to home, our ancestors invested more in raising children, which meant that our kids can develop skills far beyond what a single salmon, hatched and on its own, could ever have. Sexual reproduction supercharged diversity, creating an ongoing evolutionary arms race. When the salmon won, they reproduced in big numbers, but couldn't by definition do anything to raise their kids who were already long gone. We, on the other hand, protected our helpless babies after birth, allowing their brains to keep growing, and nurtured them to provide new skills. Our nature created the evolutionary possibility of our nurture. When we won, we built civilization. Baked-in sex drives ensured that our ancestors kept sexually reproducing, even if they didn't understand, at least on a technical level, much of what was happening. Early civilizations attributed the magic of reproduction to the gods, but our inherently inquisitive brains were hardwired to keep searching for a deeper understanding of the world around us. For millennia, very slow progress was made in understanding our biology, but our knowledge expanded considerably with the advent of the philosophies and tools of the scientific revolution. In 1677, the happy Dutchman Antony van Leeuwenhoek jumped out of bed. Inventor of a far better microscope than anything before, he had already, on his own, peered deeply into bodily fluids of blood, saliva, and tears. This time, however, he recruited his wife. After a sexual encounter, van Leeuwenhoek placed a bit of his ejaculate under his microscope and was amazed to see what he described as seminal worms wiggling around like an eel swimming in water. But what role, he wondered, did these wiggling worms play? A prominent view in Europe at the time, one that originated with the ancient Greeks, was that male semen contained homunculi, a name for tiny people waiting to start growing. The female body, according to this hypothesis, was like the soil in which a plant seed grows. An alternative belief was that female eggs contained the little mini-me's, whose growth was catalyzed by male semen. A third group of people, presumably mostly dimwits, believed life generated spontaneously, like flies emerging from rancid meat. In the 18th century, the brilliant Italian Catholic priest and polymath Lazzaro Magnifico Spallanzani crafted an ingenious experiment to test his hypothesis about procreation. Sewing tiny frog pants out of taffeta, he made it impossible for male frogs to pass their fluids to the females. Every young person learns this in sex ed today, but in the 18th century, it was big news that female frogs could not get pregnant when the male sperm was filtered by the pants. When Spallanzani artificially inseminated the female frogs with male frog sperm, the females became pregnant. The sperm, it was now clear, was an essential component of the semen needed to make the females pregnant. Magnifico! It took an additional century before scientists figured out that both the male and the female sex cells contribute equally to the fertilized egg. Learning more about how humans are made then merged with another realization our ancestors had intuitively sensed but never fully understood, the science of heredity. For millennia, our ancestors must have had an inkling about how heredity works. Every time a tall man and a tall woman had a tall child, they received a clue. When a tall man and a tall woman had a short child, they probably got a little confused, and perhaps the man cast a wary eye at the short, vivacious Casanova living one cave over. Our ancestors used this limited knowledge of heredity to start changing the world around them. Our nomadic hunter-gatherer ancestors, for example, began noticing that some of the wolves picking through their garbage were friendlier than others. Starting around 15,000 years ago, probably in Central Asia, they started breeding those friendlier wolves with each other, eventually creating dogs. Unadulterated by humans, nature, on its own devices, probably would not have morphed a proud wolf into a yapping chihuahua, but our ancestors pushed the creation of an entirely new subspecies. The same human-led domestication process transformed plants. After the vast ice sheets receded almost 12,000 years ago, our ancestors started replanting particularly useful plants they'd plucked from the wild. Long before Monsanto started genetically engineering seeds, our human ancestors noticed that a few particular plants did something different and more desirable than the others being grown. They figured out that if they planted seeds from these plants, the next generation would more often do the same great thing. Over the coming millennia, this selective breeding process was used to turn wild plants into what we know today as wheat, barley, and peas from the Middle East, rice and millet from China, and squash and corn from Mexico. As humans all around the globe either figured out animal and plant domestication on their own or were exposed to it by others, we increasingly pondered the nature of heredity. Our ancestors knew how to do heredity, but had very little understanding of how it was actually working. For millennia, great human thinkers like Hippocrates and Aristotle in ancient Greece, Charaka in India, and Abu al-Qasim al-Zarawi and Judah Halevi in Islamic Spain hypothesized about human heredity, but no one had gotten things quite right. In 1831, an English gentleman explorer with a deep curiosity finagled his way onto a 5-year survey voyage along the coasts of Africa, South America, Australia, and New Zealand. A keen observer of detail, Charles Darwin studied his environment carefully, collected huge numbers of specimens, and took meticulous notes. Returning to England in 1836, he spent the next 23 years obsessively mulling over his findings and piecing together a powerful hypothesis about how organisms evolve. Darwin recognized his theory would shock Christian morality, so he wanted to be certain he was right before publishing his work. When he learned that a competitor with ideas dangerously close to his own was about to go public, Darwin finally published On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection in 1859. In his masterpiece, Darwin described his theory that all life is related and that species evolve because small changes in heritable traits compete in a process he called natural selection. Over time, a species with traits conferring specific advantages in a given environment thrive and reproduce more than those with less advantageous configurations. If the environment changes, the different traits face different selective pressures in the never-ending process of adaptation and evolution. A highly advantageous trait in one environment might become a liability in another and vice versa. Darwin was spot on in his theory of evolution, but knew little about how heredity actually worked on a molecular level. It took another genius to unlock that mystery. At the time Darwin's great work was published, an obscure Augustinian friar, Gregor Mendel, was devoting his free time, analytical mind, and careful record-keeping to figuring out how traits were passed across generations. The brilliant son of a peasant farmer, Mendel joined the Augustinian St. Thomas Monastery in Brno, in the modern-day Czech Republic, in 1843. Immediately, he took an active interest in the work already being carried out by other monks trying to better understand how traits were passed on in sheep. Recognizing Mendel's abilities, the abbot sent young Gregor to study physics, chemistry, and zoology at the University of Vienna. After returning from his studies, Mendel convinced the abbot to give him free rein to carry out even more ambitious experiments. Breeding over 10,000 pea plants of 22 different varieties between 1856 and 1863, he meticulously recorded how various traits were passed from parent plants to their offspring, and painstakingly deduced the laws of heredity that mostly hold true today. First, Mendel confirmed, each inherited trait is defined by a pair of genes, where one gene is provided by each parent. Second, each trait is determined independent of other traits by the two genes for that trait. Third, if a gene pair has two different genes for the same trait, one form of these genes will always be dominant. Mendel published his revolutionary findings in his seminal 1866 study, Experiments in Plant Hybridization, and then nothing happened. Few scientists knew of the paper, which was originally published in the Little Red Proceedings of the Natural History Society of Brunn. Mendel's incredible work was, for the moment, lost. But when other scientists exploring the nature of heredity in 1900 stumbled upon tattered copies of Mendel's great paper, the seed of the genetic age was replanted. 10 years later, American biologist Thomas Hunt Morgan proved that the genes Mendel described are organized in structures of molecules called chromosomes. Over the coming decades, scientists showed how genetics worked across scores of different organisms. Mendelian genetics became the vehicle underpinning all of life. Combined with Darwinian evolution, it provided the essential keys needed to unlock and then transform all of biology, including our own. All genetic code is made up of very long strands of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, which provides instructions to cells for making proteins. Sexually reproducing species like ours have two paired strands of DNA in the nucleus of nearly all of our cells. Our red blood cells don't have nuclei, one from our mother and one from our father. If we were a cake, each of our parents would contribute about half of each ingredient. But rather than being made up of flour, sugar, and baking soda, our DNA is made up of four different types of molecules called nucleotides. These nucleotide bases are named guanine, adenine, thymine, and cytosine, but each is more commonly referred to by its first letter, G, A, T, or C. The G's, A's, T's, and C's are strung together like trains on two sets of parallel tracks just touching each other. The order of the trains, the sequences of the DNA we call genes, creates a unique set of instructions that are delivered by messengers called ribonucleic acid, or RNA, to the cells for making proteins. Proteins are the real actors in our cells that carry out whatever task has been assigned to them, like becoming a specified type of cell, structuring and regulating our tissues and organs, carrying oxygen, generating biochemical reactions, and growing. Our human genes are then normally packaged together into 23 pairs of DNA strands in our cells, our chromosomes, with each chromosome directing a specific set of functions in our bodies. Humans have about 21,000 genes and 3.2 billion base pairs, points on the genome, the complete set of genes in our bodies, where G's pair with C's and A's pair with T's. The genes that impact us the most are those providing instructions to our cells to create proteins, but nearly 99% of the total DNA does not code for proteins at all. These non-coding genes used to be called junk DNA because scientists thought they had no significant biological function. Today, we can think of non-coding genes like football players standing on the sideline giving encouragement, tips, and direction to their teammates on the field. These non-coding genes play an important role directing the creation of certain RNA molecules that carry instructions from our genes outside the nucleus and in regulating how the protein-coding genes are expressed. Each of our cells that has a nucleus contains the blueprint for our whole body, but the result would be chaos if every cell were trying to create the whole person. Instead, our genetic DNA is regulated by a process called epigenetics for determining which genes are expressed. A skin cell, for example, contains the blueprint of a liver cell and every other type of cell, but the epigenetic marks tell the skin cells to produce skin. In our football team analogy, each player has the entire game plan, but only needs to fulfill his or her particular function when instructed to do so. That's why the single cell of our original fertilized egg can grow into such complicated beings as ourselves. This first cell contains the instructions to generate all the different types of cells, but the cells then begin to specialize in different ways to perform their particular functions. These specialized cells, however, are not independent actors, but differentiated parts of an interconnected cellular ecosystem. And just like our organs collaborate with each other within the system of our body, our genes influence each other within the dynamic system of our genome. This all sounds very complicated, and it is. That's why it's taken hundreds of years to understand how the system works, and we're still only just beginning. But having a recipe and understanding the language of the instructions and the nature of the ingredients is a pretty critical start when baking a cake. Once scientists recognized that genes were the alphabet of the language of life, they still needed to figure out what the letters were saying to be able to read the book. The DNA double helix was the manual made up of letters, but what did the letters say? Reading the human genome in any significant way was far too difficult for humans alone, but not ultimately for humans paired with machines. In the mid-1970s, Cambridge scientists Frederick Sanger and Alan Colson invented an ingenious way to run an electric current through a gel to break up a cell's genome, staining the fragments and sorting the different nucleotides based on length, and streaming the gel through a specially designed camera to read the genetic patterns. This first-generation genome sequencing process was slow and expensive, but a gargantuan step forward. By figuring out how to automate this process and better read the flashes of light passing through the DNA letters, researchers like Lee Hood and Lloyd Smith massively increased both the speed and efficacy of genome sequencing and laid the foundation for another big step forward. When, in 1988, the U.S. National Institutes of Health launched a major initiative to supercharge development of the next generation of these DNA sequencing machines, the stage was set for an even more ambitious initiative to sequence the entire genome. The Human Genome Project, an audacious, U.S.-led international effort to sequence and map the first human genome, cost $2.7 billion and took 13 years by the time it was completed in 2003. By then, a private company led by science entrepreneur Craig Venter had pioneered an alternative approach of sequencing the human genome that was less comprehensive but far faster than the government-led effort. Together, these initiatives were truly a giant leap for humankind, and the steps have kept advancing. The launch of companies like San Diego-based Illumina and China's BGI Shenzhen have turned genome sequencing into a competitive, fast-growing, multi-billion-dollar global industry. Next-generation nanopore sequencers that electrically push DNA through tiny holes in proteins to read their contents like ticker tape have the potential to revolutionize gene sequencing even more. As the technology has gotten more accurate and powerful, costs have gone down dramatically. There is some indication of how quickly the cost of genome sequencing has decreased over the past decade and a half. Today, sequencing a full genome takes about a day and costs about $700. Illumina CEO Francis D'Souza announced in early 2017 that the company expected to be able to sequence a full genome for about $100 in the not-distant future. As the cost of sequencing falls close to the cost of materials required and genome sequencing becomes commoditized, more data will be available at less expense. Because genomics is the ultimate big data challenge, more and cheaper data will lay a foundation for more and greater discoveries. But even if sequencing were entirely ubiquitous, commoditized, and free, it wouldn't mean a thing unless scientists were able to understand what the genomes were saying. If a Martian came to Earth wanting to learn about how humans organize information, she would need to figure out that we had things called books. Then she would need to figure out that these books had pages made up of words formed by letters. That's the equivalent of what we get when identifying that DNA is organized into genes packaged in chromosomes that code for proteins instructing cells what to do. If the Martian would then want to understand what the books actually said, she'd need to figure out what the words mean and how to read them. Similarly, once scientists figured out the basics of how genes were organized, they still needed to figure out what the genes were actually doing. The good news is that they had an increasing number of tricks up their sleeve. As researchers sequenced more individual worms, flies, mice, and other relatively simple model organisms used to help understand more general biological processes, they tried to correlate differences between similar types of organisms and differences in their genes. Once they formed a hypothesis, they bred organisms with the same genetic mutation to see if the resulting offspring expressed the same trait. Eventually, scientists were able to turn on and off different genes in living animals to observe how specific traits changed as a result. They used advanced computational tools to analyze the interactions of many genes and made broader association studies to analyze ever larger genetic data sets. Understanding genetic data sets would be complicated enough if all biology was based on gene expression alone, but it is significantly more complicated. The genome is itself an incredibly complex ecosystem that interacts both with other complex systems inside an organism and with the changing environment around it. A small percentage of traits and diseases result from the expression of single genes, but most come from a group of genes working together and interacting with the broader environment. No one really knows the exact number, but it has been estimated that hundreds or thousands of genes play a role in determining complex traits like intelligence, height, and personality style. These genes don't act alone. Ribonucleic acid, or RNA, once believed to be merely a messenger between DNA and the protein-making machinery of the cell, is now understood to play an important role in gene expression. The epigenetic marks help determine how genes are expressed. Understanding how these overlapping processes influenced complex genetic traits was way too difficult in the first phase of genomics research, but figuring out the relatively small percentage of traits and diseases caused by single gene mutations was more feasible. Cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, muscular dystrophy, sickle cell disease, and Tay-Sachs are all examples of single gene mutation diseases, also known as Mendelian diseases, because they clearly follow Mendel's rules of heredity. Some of these disorders are called dominant because a child will need to inherit just one copy of a mutation from a single parent to have the disease. For recessive disorders, like Tay-Sachs, a child would need to inherit the mutation from both parents to be at risk. In some rare instances, people with these mutations don't get the particular disease, most likely because other genes counteract the mutation. Of the approximately 25,000 Mendelian diseases that have so far been identified, about 10,000 are understood well enough to match a specific gene to a specific disease outcome. Today, treatments exist only for around 5% of these. These Mendelian diseases are very rare. Only one out of every 30,000 people, for example, is born in the United States with cystic fibrosis. One of 10,000 inherits Huntington's disease, and one of 7,250 males inherit Duchenne muscular dystrophy. One of every 365 African-American children is born with sickle cell disease, a disease more prominent among groups whose recent ancestors lived in highly malarial areas. Other Mendelian disease can be one in millions, or even tens of millions or more. Many of these diseases cause terrible suffering and even premature death. But because they are so rare, society as a whole generally has less incentive to invest in finding cures to these diseases than in finding cures to more common afflictions, like cancer or heart and lung disease, that impact segments of the population with greater numbers, voice, and political power. Although some new research suggests that variants in Mendelian genes might play a greater role in more common diseases like metastatic prostate cancer, these preliminary findings have so far not shifted the incentive structure. With so many rare genetic diseases unlikely to receive the attention and resources needed to generate cures, parents and at-risk communities, inspired by the new insights coming from genetic technologies, have started to look for their own ways to protect their future children. Children born with Tay-Sachs, a genetic disease resulting from a single genetic mutation on chromosome 15, often seem fine at birth, but the destruction of their nervous systems begins soon after. By around the age of 2, most are experiencing terrible seizures and the decline of mental capacity. Many become blind and non-responsive. Most die in agony before the age of 5. About 1 in every 27 Ashkenazi Jews are carriers of the Tay-Sachs mutation, and hundreds of Jews around the world used to die of the disease each year. Today, almost none do, a miracle of both science and social organization. After scientists in 1969 identified the enzyme associated with Tay-Sachs carriers, a blood test was developed to determine carrier status among prospective parents, and Jewish communities worldwide swung into gear. Jewish community centers and synagogues in the United States, Canada, Europe, Israel, and elsewhere held screenings. Couples in which both prospective parents were carriers were advised to adopt or to get tested after pregnancy. Those mothers carrying embryos with the disease almost always chose to terminate their pregnancies, a painful choice, but perhaps less painful than watching their future children die of the disease. The Orthodox Jewish community empowered matchmakers to have marriage candidates genetically tested and steer carriers away from marrying each other. With the advent of gene sequencing, the genetic mutation responsible for Tay-Sachs was identified in 1985, and multiple mutations of the responsible gene have been identified since. Tay-Sachs is now an exceedingly rare disease among Jewish populations. In light of the proven benefits of genetic screening for Tay-Sachs, some researchers and policymakers are now calling for what they call expanded carrier testing to assess whether other categories of prospective parents have the potential to pass Mendelian diseases and disease risks to their children. Genome sequencing and biochemical enzyme level measurement were monumental breakthroughs that began to help prevent the transmission of relatively simple genetic diseases, but genetic analysis alone couldn't transform the way humans make babies unless paired with new options for applying that knowledge. The paired revolutions of in vitro fertilization, or IVF, and embryo screening created the mechanism through which genetic analysis could fundamentally transform human baby making. These revolutions had been a long time coming. Studying rabbit eggs in 1878, more than a century after Spallanzani's experiments with frog condoms, Viennese embryologist Samuel Leopold Schenk, who coincidentally studied at the University of Vienna the same time as Gregor Mendel, discovered that when he added sperm to the eggs he isolated in a glass dish, the eggs started dividing. These were the very early years of understanding the reproduction process, but Schenk correctly surmised the eggs were being fertilized. That mammal eggs could be fertilized in a dish suggested that these fertilized eggs could potentially be implanted into the mother and taken to term. In theory, yes, but in practice, not yet. It would take another 80 years until American scientist M.C. Chang successfully impregnated a rabbit with an egg fertilized in a glass dish, or using the Latin phrase, in vitro. But making a bunny was still a far cry from making a human baby. That, too, was coming. At a historic meeting at the Royal Society of Medicine in London in 1968, biomedical researcher Robert Edwards, one of the world's leading experts on human egg development, approached the leading developer of the surgical process for inspecting a woman's pelvis, obstetrician Patrick Steptoe. Edwards proposed they explore whether human in vitro fertilization could be used to treat infertility. Over the coming decade, the two worked feverishly and published a dazzling string of high-profile scientific papers describing every aspect of what would be required to make human in vitro fertilization possible. In 1972, Steptoe and Edwards started human trials. Working with nurse Jean Purdy, they carefully extracted eggs from more than 100 different women, fertilized them with sperm, and then tried to surgically implant the now fertilized eggs into the prospective mothers. Every one of these efforts failed. In 1976, a woman finally became pregnant with an egg fertilized in vitro, but the pregnancy failed when the early stage embryo attached outside the uterus. Then, in 1977, Leslie Brown, a homemaker from Bristol, England, entered the clinic. Leslie and her husband, John, a railroad worker, had been trying without success to have a baby for 9 years and were desperate. Leslie's pregnancy took with the first fertilized egg implanted. 9 months later, on July 25, 1978, their healthy baby, Louise, was born. Newspapers across the globe heralded the baby of the century. When asked just a few months later, a shocking 93% of Americans said they had heard about the English baby born from an egg fertilized outside her mother. Although Louise was conceived in a dish, the popular perception was that she and babies like her were created in a test tube. The pejorative name test tube babies stuck. Many people, like the majority of Americans polled by Pew that year, had a favorable view of this process. Others felt differently. Catholic theologians called the test tube baby process unnatural and a moral abomination because it did not involve sexual consummation between husband and wife, and because the process generated embryos that were not implanted and therefore needed to be discarded. The American Medical Association opposed test tube baby making as too aggressive. Nova magazine called it the biggest threat since the atom bomb. Leading conservative bioethicist Leon Kass said it called into question the idea of the humanness of our human life and the meaning of our embodiment, our sexual being, and our relation to ancestors and descendants. Leslie and John Brown were inundated with hate mail, including blood-spattered parcels containing plastic fetuses. But, as in many such situations, a process that was once shocking and controversial became more accepted and normalized over time. As the science of test tube babies became less controversial and developed a more technical name, a group of scientists was already imagining the next frontier. Why couldn't cells, they wondered, be taken from an early-stage pre-implanted embryo during IVF and then sequenced using ever-advancing sequencing technology? As early as 1967, IVF pioneer Robert Edwards and his British colleague Richard Gardner described their process for removing a few cells from pre-implanted rabbit embryos and screening them under the microscope to determine the sex of the future bunny. In 1990, 12 years after Louise Brown was born, doctors for the first time successfully screened a pre-implanted human embryo for gender and a few sex-linked and single-gene disorders. This screening process became known as pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. The PGD procedure developed rapidly, particularly for higher-risk prospective mothers. A parallel and related process called pre-implantation genetic screening, or PGS, was also developed to screen embryos without a known disease risk to assess their chances of thriving. PGD and PGS have more recently been grouped together semantically under the broader umbrella label of pre-implantation genetic testing, or PGT. PGT has been around for nearly 30 years, but these are still the early days of this incredibly significant procedure. At first, scientists used PGT primarily to test for the chromosomal abnormalities that can cause miscarriages. It then started to be used to test for a small number of specific single-gene disease-causing mutations. Today, PGT is also used to screen for some of the estimated 10,000 single-gene mutation disorders. Unlike prenatal testing of embryos already in the mother's womb, PGT can be carried out on multiple early-stage fertilized eggs, or blastocysts, in a dish. In most cases, diseases that PGT tests for in these unimplanted embryos are exceedingly rare individually. Collectively, however, they are not. Statistics vary, but recent studies estimate the likelihood of having a traditionally conceived child who carries one of these diseases at about 1-2%. For the rapidly growing number of screenable single-gene mutation diseases, the likelihood of a child conceived through IVF and PGT carrying the disease would be massively reduced. As the number of harmful genetic abnormalities that can be avoided by using IVF and PGT increases, parents will need to weigh the costs and benefits of conceiving children through sex versus in the lab. And while the considerable health and other benefits of conception inside the woman through sex will remain constant, and some small additional risk associated with the IVF process itself could conceivably be uncovered, the real and perceived health benefits of IVF and embryo screening are likely to increase over time. Think about all the precautions parents take to protect their children from harm and help them thrive. Mothers swallow prenatal vitamins, douse their own hands and their children's hands in antibacterial sanitizers, have their young kids wear seat belts in cars and helmets on bikes, and serve their children healthy foods. Even though the risk of each different danger varies, modern parents have come to believe that a big part of their job description involves reducing these risks as much as possible, and often disdain other parents who make different choices. Most American parents' response to the anti-vaccination movement is a case in point. when 147 mostly unvaccinated children were infected with measles in 2015 after exposure at Disneyland, the children's parents were roundly condemned for putting hundreds of other kids in danger, while anti-vaccination advocates argue they are doing something natural by not vaccinating their children for communicable diseases. It is hard to argue they are actually doing something good. Vaccinations have saved millions of lives since the first smallpox vaccine was introduced in 19th century England. Repeated studies around the world have clearly proven the safety and overwhelming individual and communal benefits of vaccination. Nevertheless, irrational and uninformed fears of vaccines have persisted. In recent years, celebrities like Jenny McCarthy, Jim Carrey, and Donald Trump have raised scientifically unsupported claims about the dangers of vaccines that have fueled a quadrupling of the number of unvaccinated U.S. children since 2001. This same type of conflict between groups of parents taking action to harness or reject as unnatural scientific advances will also play out with embryo screening. With the increasing quality and ease of non-invasive prenatal blood tests, many parents already have ever more information about the genetic status of the embryo growing inside the mother. But the anguish of deciding whether to terminate a pregnancy based on genetic abnormalities that could lead to later stage problems will seem more painful and less beneficial than selecting upfront a pre-implanted embryo based on statistical probabilities of health. As the number of single gene mutation diseases that can be screened for during IVF and PGT continues to rise, the cost goes down, and the safety of IVF and PGT improves, the value of screening and selecting embryos in the laboratory prior to implantation will increase. At first, parents will balance their faith in reproduction by sex against the benefits of embryo screening. This will not over time be a fair fight. With more genetic diseases becoming avoidable, parents who conceive children the old-fashioned way will seem like today's anti-vaccination zealots. As societal norms about baby-making change, more prospective parents will come to see conception through sex as unnecessarily risky. We'll still have sex for all the wonderful reasons we do now, just not as much for making babies. More parents will want their children to be conceived outside the mother so the embryos can be sequenced, selected, and in the more distant future, altered. Although some parents will opt out of this process for ideological reasons, or because they get excited together in the backseat of a hovercraft, sexual conception will come with costs. How many people will watch their neighbor's child die from a preventable genetic disease before starting to blame the parents? Will they see these parents as the next natural heroes of Disneyland, or as ideologues who took unnecessary risks that harmed their children? A test case for assessing how far prospective parents will go to prevent genetic abnormalities in their offspring has been carried out in Iceland in recent years. Babies with Down syndrome are born with an extra copy of chromosome 21, which can lead to heart defects, developmental and cognitive impairments, increased cancer and mortality risk, and other challenges. Nevertheless, many grow into happy, well-functioning adults who make meaningful contributions to the people around them and society at large. Most people with children, siblings, spouses, or friends with Down syndrome recognize them as the blessing they are. Since the early 2000s, Icelandic doctors have been required to inform expectant mothers that available screening tests covered by the National Health Plan can indicate with a high degree of certainty whether their future children will have Down syndrome or other genetic disorders. In the decade or so since these tests became available, nearly all the women who received a positive indication for Down syndrome have chosen to terminate their pregnancies. Iceland's termination rate for pregnancies where Down syndrome has been diagnosed largely tracks many other countries. In Australia, China, Denmark, and the United Kingdom, for example, termination rates range from 90% to 98%. With its raging, religion-infused abortion debate, the United States is in many ways an outlier among developed countries. When asked in 2007, only 20% of Americans believed parents should be allowed to terminate a pregnancy if their fetus has a serious but non-fatal genetic disease or condition such as Down syndrome. But 67% of Americans actually choose to terminate their pregnancies after Down syndrome is diagnosed. The contradictory figures show just how excruciating these decisions can be. Critics of universal screening and termination of fetuses indicating Down syndrome raise very valid questions. Who is to say the life of someone with Down syndrome is worth less than anyone else's? What possible moral criteria could be used to make such a determination? These deeply personal questions cut to the core of our very humanity. But these existential questions won't necessarily be what prospective parents will be asking themselves when IVF and pre-implantation embryo selection become the norm. If most mothers and parents in the developed world are already making the often agonizing decision to terminate existing pregnancies where Down syndrome and other genetic disorders have been diagnosed, imagine what will happen when the choice being made is the less fraught decision about which among the 15 or so early-stage embryos in a dish to implant. All of these early-stage embryos will be a prospective parent's natural children, but only one or two of them can be chosen at a time to take to term. Doctors performing IVF in fertility clinics are already selecting embryos to reduce the chances of miscarriage. Would we really expect a prospective mother to be agnostic about which among her unimplanted in vitro embryos would be implanted if some might inherit debilitating and life-shortening diseases? Would we want it to be legal for prospective parents to affirmatively choose to implant a baby with Down syndrome or death sentence diseases like Huntington's or Tay-Sachs if it were a choice? When writing this book, I asked on my Facebook page whether my friends would be willing to edit their pre-implanted embryos to give their future children additional traits and capabilities. As a mom with a kiddo with Down syndrome, an old friend wrote, "This is a tough dilemma. If I could have chosen, I believe I would prefer my son not have DS, Down syndrome, but our lives have truly been enriched by this diagnosis. We have a second family that is always there to help no matter what, and he teaches me something new every single day. He's one of the most fun and funny five-year-olds I know. On the other hand, if I could prevent the struggles he has already faced and those that he will continue to face, I think I would want to prevent that. Every parent wants their kid to be happy and excel at whatever it is that creates that happiness." Saying that parents would not choose to implant embryos carrying Down syndrome is not at all to suggest that the lives of existing children with abnormalities like this are any less valuable than anyone else's. But because parents around the world are already making the far tougher decision to terminate pregnancies when these kinds of abnormalities appear, it seems likely that parents will affirmatively want to screen out genetic diseases before their pregnancies even begin. Choosing from among pre-implanted embryos in a lab will simply seem far less brutal than abortion. Governments and insurance companies, at least those in jurisdictions with rational healthcare systems and where the abortion debate is muted, will also have significant incentives to encourage IVF and pre-implantation embryo screening to avoid having to pay for lifetime care for what will come to be seen as avoidable genetic diseases. A relatively simple calculation helps make this point. Most babies born with early-onset genetic diseases spend around 3 weeks in the neonatal intensive care units of hospitals at an average cost of $3,000 a day, or around $60,000 each, and the costs often go up rapidly from there. The mean additional annual cost in the United States for treating cystic fibrosis is $15,571. Because the average lifespan for people with cystic fibrosis is 37 years, the lifetime additional health care cost for a person with cystic fibrosis would be nearly $600,000. Considering that there are 30,000 people in the United States with cystic fibrosis, the total additional annual expenditure on cystic fibrosis alone is about $467 million. The same calculation model arrives at a lifetime total cost of $100 to $150 million for treating the 30,000 Americans with Huntington's disease and $850 million for treating the roughly 200,000 Americans with Down syndrome. All of these costs are necessary investments in people's loved ones, who deserve every opportunity to reach their potential and enjoy the lives they have, and no price can be set for ameliorating the suffering of even a single human being. And yet, we do make these choices every day through our institutions. If America deployed its full gross domestic product toward curing or treating a particular disease, chances are we could make significant progress. We don't make this investment because we are indifferent to this one disease, but because societies require balancing different valuable interests against each other to function. For pre-implantation embryo screening to become accessible to everyone, therefore, the social benefits would need to outweigh the financial and other costs. If screening all the embryos in the United States for a range of genetic disorders prior to implantation could be done for $1 less than the total cost of treating for life all the people born with those disorders, society would come out ahead economically while reducing overall levels of pain and suffering. Dividing the total annual cost of treating all these diseases by the total number of babies born each year in the United States gives us a preliminary guess of the point at which every prospective parent could receive IVF and pre-implantation embryo screening at no additional cost to society. A rough back-of-the-envelope calculation helps make this point. Around 4 million children are born in the United States each year. Assuming that 2% of them are born with genetic diseases, that would mean 80,000 children. If each of these children had a genetic disease equivalent in cost to the additional roughly $600,000 spent for lifetime care for a person with cystic fibrosis, that would mean spending an additional $48 billion over the next 37 years. If we created an embryo screening bond to bring forward this future expenditure to apply it today, we'd have about $16,500 to spend on IVF and PGT for each American woman wanting to have a child. If we included in our calculations the costs of many other genetic and partially genetic diseases that show up later in life, like diabetes, Alzheimer's, and certain cancers, the $16,500 figure would go up farther. IVF in the United States is an incredibly expensive procedure, usually costing between $12,000 and $30,000 a round. Because couples go through an average of 3 cycles, these costs quickly become prohibitive to most Americans. But the cost of IVF is far lower in other countries. In Turkey, it costs around $8,500, Britain, $8,000, Spain, $5,600, Mexico, $4,000, Korea, $3,000, and Poland, $1,200. In Israel, where IVF without limit is covered by the National Health Plan for women under 45, national IVF rates are growing at double digits, success rates are high, and costs for medical tourists from abroad are low. If the cost of IVF and embryo selection in the United States remains high, parents of even moderate means have the ability to go elsewhere for these services. As IVF and embryo screening become the norm, however, prospective parents around the world will increasingly demand these services be covered under their health plans. Competition among IVF providers will force prices down, and access and quality and our understanding of what the pre-implanted embryo's genes are saying will go up. The consumers, medical providers, and insurance company and/or government payers will all be incentivized to want the same outcome. Forward-thinking employers are already coming along. In 2014, Apple and Facebook announced they would cover the cost of egg freezing for their female employees. This was condemned by a number of prominent women as a ploy to trick women into deferring motherhood and keep working. More people, however, including Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, saw it as an inevitable step toward empowering women with more reproductive options. Since then, many companies, including Amazon, Google, Intel, Microsoft, Spotify, and Wayfair, have followed suit. More recently, companies such as Starbucks, Facebook, Uber, and News Corp have begun covering IVF as part of their employee health plans. According to a survey conducted by Fertility IQ, women working for companies that provide IVF benefits felt a significant bump in their loyalty to their employer. As more employees demand this type of coverage, the best and most competitive employers will provide it. The intersection of inexpensive and ubiquitous genome sequencing, IVF, embryo selection, and shifting cultural attitudes and financing models will propel more of us to make babies in the future very differently than how we have to date. What we've done in the back seat will itself take the back seat, because parents won't get the benefits of genetic selection if they conceive their children through sex. This coming shift away from natural conception would be likely if our understanding of the genome was only advancing linearly, but it is inevitable in light of the exponential progress being made in understanding our genes and how they are expressed. Assessing how much we can ultimately learn from the extracted and sequenced cells taken from pre-implanted embryos during PGT requires us to ask even bigger questions about what genes do and how important they are in determining who we are.